ideas he had had earlier. It takes servants to make an autocrat. And there had been servants here. The kitchen was tremendous. It must have required a score of chefs, with their own servants, to carry the finished product out to the banquet hall, return the dirty dishes, clean up, run errands. There were bins that had held fresh fruit and vegetables, and now held dust and fruit pits and dried skins and mold. There was a cold room where carcasses had hung. It was empty and warm. There was a freezer, still working. Some of the food on the freezer shelves might have been edible, but Louis would not have risked it. There were no cans. The water spigots were dry. Aside from the freezer, there was not a machine more complex than a door hinge. There were no temperature indicators or timers on the stoves. There was nothing equivalent to a toaster. There were threads hanging over the stove, with nodules of crud on them. Raw spices? No spice bottles? Louis looked once around him before he left. Otherwise, he might have missed the truth. This room had not originally been a kitchen. What then? A storage room? A tri-D room? Probably the latter. One wall was very blank, with a uniform paint job that looked younger than the rest, and there were scars on the floor where chairs and couches might have been removed. All right, then. The room had been an entertainment room. Then maybe the wall set had broken down, and nobody remembered how to fix it. Later, the auto kitchen had gone the same route. So the big tri-D room had been turned into a manually operated kitchen. Such kitchens must have been common by then if nobody remembered how to fix an auto kitchen. Raw foods had been brought up by flying truck. And when the flying trucks broke down, one by one? Louis left. He found the banquet hall at last and the only dependable source of food in the castle. There, he breakfasted on a brick from the kitchen slot in his cycle. He was finishing up when Speaker entered. The Kazin must have been starving. He went straight to his cycle, dialed three wet, dark red bricks, and gulped them down in nine swallows. Only then did he turn to look at Louis. He was no longer ghost white. Sometime during the night, the foam had finished healing him and had sloughed away. His skin showed glossy and pink and healthy, if pink was the color of healthy Kazinti skin, with a few ridges of gray scar tissue and an extensive network of violet veins. "Come with me," the Kazin commanded. "I have found a map room." Chapter 16. The Map Room. The map room was at the very top of the castle, as befitted its importance. Louis was blowing hard from the climb. He had had a time keeping up. The Kazin did not run, but he walked faster than a man could walk. Louis reached the landing as Speaker pushed through a double door ahead of him. Through that gap, Louis saw a horizontal band of jet black, 8 inches broad and 3 feet off the ground. He looked beyond it, looked for a similar strip of baby blue checked with midnight blue rectangles, and he found it. Jackpot. Louis stood in the doorway, taking in details. The miniature ring world was almost as large as the room, which was circular and perhaps 120 feet across. At the hub of the circular map was a rectangular screen, heavily mounted, facing away from the doorway but built to turn. High on the walls were 10 turning globes. They varied in size and they turned at different rates, but each was the characteristic color, rich blue with swirled white frosting, of an Earth-like world. There was a conic section map below each globe.
"I spent the night here working," said Speaker.
He was standing behind the screen.
"I have many things to show you. Come here."
Louis almost ducked under the ring. A thought stopped him. The hawk-featured man who ruled the banquet hall would never have stooped so, not even to enter this holy of holies. Louis walked at the ring and through it, and found it was a holoprojection. He took up a stance behind the Kazin. Control panels surrounded the screen. All the knobs were large and massive, made of silver, and each was carved to represent the head of some animal. The boards were contoured in swirls and curves. Prettified, Louis thought. Decadent. The screen was alight but unmagnified. Looking into it was like looking down on the ring world from the vicinity of the shadow squares. Louis felt a touch of déjà vu.
I had it focused earlier, said the Kazin, if I remember rightly.
He touched a knob and the view expanded so fast that Louis's hand clutched for a throttle.
I want to show you the rim wall. A bit off.
He touched another fierce-visaged knob, and the view slid. They were looking over the edge of the ring world. Somewhere were telescopes to give them this view.
Where?
Mounted on the shadow squares? They were looking down on thousand-mile-high mountains. Still the view expanded as Speaker found ever finer controls. Louis marveled at how abruptly the mountains, appearing very natural but for their size, were cut by the knife-edged shadow of space. Then he saw what ran along the peaks of the mountains. Though it was only a line of silver dots, he knew what it would be.
A linear accelerator!
Yes, said Speaker. Without transfer booths, it is the only feasible way to travel ringworld distances. It must have been the major transport system.
But it's 1,000 miles high. Elevators?
I found elevator shafts all along the rim wall. There, for instance.
By now, the silver thread was a line of tiny loops, widely spaced, each hidden from the land below by a mountain peak. A tube so slender as to be barely visible led from one of the loops, down the slope of a mountain, into a layer of clouds at the bottom of the ringworld atmosphere.
Speaker said, "The electromagnetic loops cluster thickly around the elevator shafts. Elsewhere, they're up to 1,000,000 miles apart. I surmise that they are not needed except for starting and stopping and guidance. A car could be accelerated to free fall, coast around the rim at a relative 770 miles per second, to be stopped near an elevator tube by another cluster of loops."
It'd take up to 10 days to get a man where he wants to go, not counting accelerations.
Trivial. It takes you 60 days to reach Silver Eyes, the human world farthest from Earth. You would need 4 times that long to cross known space from edge to edge.
True. And the living area on the ring world was greater than that of all known space. They built for room when they built this thing.
Louis asked, "Did you see any sign of activity? Is anyone still using the linear accelerator?" "The question is meaningless. Let me show you."
The view converged, slid sidewise, expanded slowly.
It was night. Dark clouds diverged over dark land, and then...
city lights. Well...
Louis swallowed.
It had come too suddenly.
"So it's not all dead. We can get help." "I do not think so. This may be difficult to find.
Finnegal's black mind."
The castle, obviously their own castle, floated serenely over a field of light. Windows, neon, streams of floating light motes which must be vehicles. Oddly shaped floating buildings. Lovely.
"Tapes. Tangent, we're watching old tapes.
I thought they must be live transmissions."
For one glorious moment it had seemed that their search was over. Lighted, bustling cities pinpointed on a map for them. But these pictures must be ages old, civilizations old.
"I thought so also, for many hours last night. I did not suspect the truth until I failed to find the thousands of miles of meteor crater slashed by the Liar's Landing."
Louis, speechless, thwacked the Kazin on his nude pink and lavender shoulder. It was as high as he could reach. The Kazin ignored the liberty.
"After I had located the castle, things proceeded quickly. Observe."
He caused the view to slide rapidly to port. The dark land blurred, lost all detail. Then they were over black ocean. The camera seemed to back up.
"You see? A bay of one of the major salt oceans falls across our path to the rim wall. The ocean itself is several times as large as any on Kazin or Earth. The bay is as large as our largest ocean."
"More delay. Can't we get over it?"
"Perhaps we can, but we face greater delay than that."
The Kazin reached for a knob.
"Hold it. I want a closer look at those groups of islands."
"Why, Louis? That we might stop for provisions?"
"No. Did you see how they tend to form clusters, with wide stretches of deep water between? Take that grouping there." Louis's forefinger circled images on the screen. Now look up at that map.
I do not understand.
And that grouping in what you call a bay, and that map behind you. The continents on the conic projections are a little distorted. See it now? 10 worlds, 10 clusters of islands. They aren't one-to-one scale, but I'll bet that island is as big as Australia, and the original continent doesn't look any bigger than Eurasia on the globe.
What a macabre jest. Louis, does this represent a typical human sense of humor?
No, no, no. Sentiment. Unless...
Yes?
I hadn't thought of that. The first generation, they had to throw away their own worlds, but they wanted to keep something of what they were losing. 3 generations later, it would be funny. It's always that way.
When the Kazin was sure Louis had finished, he asked somewhat diffidently,
"Do you humans feel that you understand Kazinti?"
Louis smiled and shook his head.
"Good," said the Kazin, and changed the subject. "I spent some time last night examining the nearest spaceport."
They stood at the hub of the miniature ringworld, looking through a rectangular window into the past. The past they saw was one of magnificent achievement. Speaker had focused the screen on the spaceport, a wide projecting ledge on the spaceward side of the rim wall. They watched as an enormous blunt-ended cylinder, alight with 1,000 windows, was landed in electromagnetic cradling fields. The fields glowed in pastel shades, probably so that the operators could manipulate them visually.
"The tape is looped," said Speaker. "I watched it for some time last night. The passengers seemed to walk directly into the rim wall, as if a kind of osmosis process were being used."
"Yeah." Louis was badly depressed. The spaceport ledge was far to spinward of them, a distance to dwarf the distance they had already traveled.
"I watched a ship take off. They did not use the linear accelerator. They used it only for landings, to match the velocity of the ship to that of the spaceport. For takeoffs, the ship simply tumbled off into space. It was as the Leaf-Eater guessed, Louis. Remember the trapdoor arrangement? The ringworld spins easily fast enough for a ram scoop field to operate. Louis, are you listening?"
Louis shook himself. "Sorry. All I can think about is that this adds about 700,000 miles to our trip."
"It may be possible to use the main transport system, the small linear accelerator at the top of the rim wall."
"Not a chance. It's probably wrecked. Civilization tends to spread if there's a transport system to spread it. And even if we can get it working, we aren't moving toward an elevator shaft."
"That is true," said the Kazin. "I looked for one."
In the rectangular screen, the ship was down. Floating trucks ran a jointed tube to the ship's main lock. Passengers spilled into the tube.
"Shall we change our goal?"
"We can't. The spaceport is still our best chance."
"Is it?"
"Yes, Tangit. Big as it is, the ringworld is a colony world. Civilization always centers around the spaceport on a colony world."
"Because craft come from the home world carrying news of technological innovations. We surmise that the ringworlders have abandoned their home world."
"But the ships can still come in," Louis said doggedly, "from the abandoned worlds, from centuries ago. Ram ships are subject to relativity, to time dilation."
"You hope to find old spacemen trying to teach the old skills to savages who have forgotten them." "And you may be right," said Speaker. "But I weary of this structure, and this spaceport is very far. What else can I show you on the map screen?"
Suddenly, Louis asked, "How far have we come since we left the Lyre?"
"I told you I could not find our impact crater. Your guess is as accurate as mine. But I know how far we must go. From the castle to the rim is approximately 200,000 miles.
"A long way. But you must have found the mountain."
"No."
"The big one, Fist of God. We crashed practically on its slope."
"No."
"I don't like that. Speaker, is there any way we could have gotten off course? You should have found Fist of God just by backtracking starboard from the castle."
"But I did not," Speaker said with finality. "Do you wish to see anything more? For example, there are blank areas. Probably they are due only to warn Tate, but I wondered if they might not conceal places on the Ringworld whose nature is secret.
But we'd have to go there ourselves to find out.
Speaker suddenly turned to face the double doors, his ears spread like fans. Silently, he dropped to all fours and leapt. Louis blinked. What could have caused that? And then he heard it. Considering its age, the castle machinery had been remarkably silent. Now there came a low-pitched hum from outside the double doors. Speaker was out of sight. Louis drew his flashlight laser and followed cautiously. He found the Kazin at the head of the stairs. He put the weapon away, and together they watched Teela ride up.
"They only go up," Teela told them, "not down. The one between the sixth and seventh floors won't go at all."
Louis asked the obvious question.
"How do you make them move?"
"You just grip the banister and push forward. That way it won't go unless you're hanging on. Safer. I only found out by accident."
"You would. I climbed 10 flights of stairs this morning."
"How many did you climb before you found out?"
"None. I was going up for breakfast. I tripped on the first step and grabbed for the banister."
"Right. It figures."
Teela looked hurt.
"It's not my fault if you..."
"Sorry. Did you get your breakfast?"
"No. I've been watching people move around below us."
"Did you know there's a public square just under the building?"
Speaker's ears opened wide. "Is there? And it is not deserted?"
"No, they've been filing in from all directions all morning. By now there must be hundreds of them."
She smiled like dawn breaking.
"And they're singing."
There were wide spots along all the corridors of the castle. Each such alcove was furnished with rugs and couches and tables, apparently so that any group of strollers could take a meal whenever he fancied, wherever he might be. In one such dining nook, near the basement level of the castle, was a long window bent at right angles to form half a wall, half a floor. Louis was panting a little from having descended 10 flights of stairs. He found himself fascinated by the dining table. Its top seemed sculpted, but the contours were shaped and placed to suggest soup plates, salad or butter or dinner plates, or coasters for the bottom of a mug. Decades or centuries of use had stained the hard white material. "You wouldn't use plates," Louis speculated. "You'd dish the food into the depressions and hose the table off afterward." It seemed unsanitary, but...
"They wouldn't bring flies or mosquitoes or wolves. Why should they bring bacteria?"
"Colonic bacteria," he answered himself, "for digestion. And if one bacteria mutated, turning vicious..." By then there would be no immunity to anything. Was that how the Ringworld civilization had died? Any civilization requires a minimum number to maintain it.
Teela and Speaker were paying him no attention. They knelt in the bend of the window, looking down. Louis went to join them.
"They're still at it," said Teela. And they were. Louis guessed that 1,000 people were looking up at him. They were not chanting now.
"They can't know we're here," he said.
Speaker suggested, "Perhaps they worship the building."
"Even so, they can't do this every day. We're too far from the edge of town. They couldn't reach the fields."
"Perhaps we happen by on a special day, the holy day."
Teela said, "Maybe something happened last night, something special, like us. Or if someone spotted us after all. Or like that."
She pointed.
"I wondered about that," said Speaker. "How long has it been falling?"
"Since I woke up, at least. It's like a rain or a new kind of snow. Wire from the shadow squares, mile after mile of it. Why do you suppose it fell here?"
Louis thought of 6 million miles of distance between each shadow square, of an entire 6 million mile strand torn loose by its impact with the lyre, falling with the lyre toward the Ringworld landscape, on nearly the same course. It was hardly surprising that they had come across part of that enormous strand. He was not in a long-winded mood.
"Coincidence," he said. "Anyway, it's draped all over us, and it's been falling since last night, probably. The natives must have worshipped the castle already because it floats."
"Consider," the Kazin said slowly, "if Ringworld engineers were to appear today,
floating down from this floating castle. It would be taken as more appropriate than surprising. Louis, shall we try the god gambit?
Louis turned to answer, and couldn't. He could only try to keep a straight face. He might have made it, but Speaker was explaining to Teela.
It was Louis' suggestion that we might succeed better with the natives by posing as Ringworld engineers. You and Louis were to be acolytes. Nessus was to be a captive demon, but we can hope to do without him. I was to be more god than engineer, a kind of war god.
Then Teela started to laugh, and Louis broke up. 8 feet tall, inhumanly broad across the shoulders and hips, the Kazin was too big and too toothy to be other than fearsome, even when burnt bald. His rat-like tail had always been his least impressive feature. Now his skin was the same color, baby pink, crisscrossed with lavender capillaries. Without the fur to bulk out his head, his ears became ungainly pink parasols. Orange fur made a domino mask across his eyes, and he seemed to have grown his own fluffy orange pillow to sit on. The danger of laughing at a Kazin only made it funnier. Doubled over, with his arms around his middle, laughing silently now because he could not inhale, Louis backed toward what he hoped was a chair. An inhumanly large hand closed on his shoulder and lifted him high. Still convulsed with mirth, Louis faced the Kazin at eye level. He heard,
"Truly, Louis, you must explain this behavior."
Louis made an enormous effort.
A kind of war god, he said, and was off again.
Teela was making hiccuping sounds. The Kazin let him down and waited for the fit to pass.
"You simply aren't impressive enough to play god," Louis said some minutes later. "Not until the hair grows back."
"But if I tore some humans to pieces with my hands, perhaps they would respect me then."
"They'd respect you from a distance and from hiding. That wouldn't do us any good." "No, we'll just have to wait for the hair. Even then, we ought to have Nessus's task."
"The puppeteer is unavailable."
"But—"
"I say he is unavailable. How shall we contact the natives?"
"You'll have to stay here, see what you can learn from the map room."
"Teela and I—" said Louis, and suddenly remembered.
"Teela, you haven't seen the map room."
"What's it like?" "You stay here and get Speaker to show you. I'll go down alone. You two can monitor me by communicator disk, and come for me if there's trouble. Speaker, I want your flashlight laser."
The Kazin grumbled, but he did relinquish the flashlight laser. It still left him with the modified slaver disintegrator. From 1,000 feet over their heads, he heard their reverent silence become a murmur of astonishment. And he knew that they had seen him, a bright speck separating from the castle window. He sank toward them. The murmur did not die. It was suppressed. He could hear the difference. Then the singing began.
"It drags," Teela had said, "and they don't keep in step, and it all sounds flat."
Louis's imagination had gone on from there. As a result, the singing took him by surprise. It was much better than he had expected. He guessed they were singing a 12-tone scale. The octave scale of most of the human worlds was also a 12-tone scale, but with differences. Small wonder it had sounded flat to Teela. Yes, it dragged. It was church music, slow and solemn and repetitive, without harmony, but it had grandeur. The square was immense. 1,000 people were a vast throng after weeks of loneliness, but the square could have held 10 times that number. Loudspeakers could have kept them singing in step, but there were no loudspeakers. A lone man waved his arms from a pedestal in the center of the square, but they would not look at him. They were all looking up at Louis Wu. For all that, the music was beautiful. Teela could not hear that beauty. The music of her experience had come from recordings and tri-D sets, always by way of a microphone system. Such music could be amplified, rectified, the voices multiplied or augmented, the bad takes thrown away. Teela Brown had never heard live music. Louis Wu had. He slowed his cycle to give his nerve ends time to adapt to the rhythms of it. He remembered the great public sings on the cliffs above Crash Landing City, Throngs which had boasted twice this number, sings which had sounded different for that and another reason. For Louis Wu had been singing too. Now, as he let the music vibrate in him, his ears began to adjust to the slightly sharp or flat notes, to the blurring of voices, to the repetition, to the slow majesty of the hymn. He caught himself as he was about to join in the singing. That's not a good idea, he thought, and let his cycle settle toward the square. The pedestal in the center of the square had once held a statue. Louis identified the human-like footprints, each 4 feet long, that marked where the statue had stood. Now the pedestal housed a kind of triangular altar, and a man stood with his back to the altar waving his arms as the people sang. Flash of pink above gray robe. Louis assumed that the man was wearing a headpiece, perhaps of pink silk. He chose to land on the pedestal itself. He was just touching down when the conductor turned to face him. As a result, he almost wrecked the cycle. It was pink scalp Louis had seen. Unique in this crowd of heads like golden flowers, faces of blonde hair with eyes peeping through, this man's face was as naked as Louis Wu's own. With a straight-armed gesture, palms down, the man held the last note of the singing, held it for seconds, then cut it. A fragment of a second later, the tail of it drifted in from the edges of the square. The priest faced Louis Wu in a sudden silence. He was as tall as Louis Wu, tall for a native. The skin of his face and scalp were so pale as to be nearly translucent, like a we-made-it albino. He must have shaved many hours ago with a razor that was not sharp enough, and now the stubble was emerging, adding its touch of gray everywhere but for the two circles around his eyes. He spoke with a note of reproof, or so it seemed. The translator disc instantly said, "So you have come at last." "We didn't know we were expected," Louis said truthfully. He was not confident enough to try a god gambit based on himself. In a long lifetime, he had learned that telling a consistent set of lies could get hellishly complicated. "You grow hair on your head," said the priest. "One presumes that your blood is less than pure, O engineer." So that was it. The race of the engineers must have been totally bald, so that this priest must imitate them by using a blunt razor on his tender skin. Or had the engineers used DePille cream or something just as easy, for no reason more pressing than fashion? The priest looked very like the wire portrait in the banquet hall. "My blood is of no concern to you," Louis said, shelving the problem. "We are on our way to the rim of the world. What can you tell us about our route?" The priest was apparently puzzled. "You ask information from me? You an engineer?" "I am not an engineer." Louis held his hand ready to activate the sonic fold. But the priest only looked more bewildered. "Then why are you half hairless? How do you fly? Have you stolen secrets from heaven? What do you want here? Have you come to steal my congregation?" The last question seemed the important one. "We're on our way to the rim. All we need here is information." "Surely your answers are in heaven." "Don't be flippant with me," Louis said evenly. "But you came directly from heaven. I saw you." "Oh, the castle. We've gone through the castle, but it didn't tell us much. For instance, were the engineers really hairless?" "I have sometimes thought that they only shave as I do. Yet your own chin seems naturally hairless."
"I depilate."
Louis looked about him at the sea of reverent golden flower faces. "What do they believe? They don't seem to share your doubts."
"They see us talking as equals in the language of the engineers. I would have this continue if it please you."
Now the priest's manner seemed conspiratorial rather than hostile.
"Would that improve your standing with them?"
"I suppose it would," said Louis.
The priest really had feared to lose his congregation, as any priest might if his god came to life and tried to take over.
"Can't they understand us?"
"Perhaps one word in 10."
At this point, Louis had cause to regret the efficiency of his translator disc. He could not tell if the priest was speaking the language of Zignamu Click-Click. Knowing that, knowing how far the two languages had diverged since the breakdown in communications, he might have been able to date the fall of civilization. "What was this castle called heaven?" he asked. "Do you know?" The legends speak of Zriller, said the priest, and of how he ruled all the lands under heaven. On this pedestal stood Zriller's statue, which was life-sized. The lands supplied heaven with delicacies, which I could name if you like, as we learn their names by rote, but in these days they do not grow. Shall I? No, thanks. What happened? A sing-song quality had crept into the man's voice. He must have heard this tale many times, and told it many times. Heaven was made when the engineers made the world and the arch. He who rules heaven rules the land from edge to edge. So Zriller ruled, for many lifetimes, throwing sunfire from heaven when he was displeased. Then it was suspected that Zriller could no longer throw sunfire. The people no longer obeyed him. They did not send food. They pulled down the statue. When Zriller's angels dropped rocks from the heights, the people dodged and laughed. There came a day when the people tried to take heaven by way of the rising stairway. But Zriller caused the stairway to fall. Then his angels left heaven in flying cars. Later it was regretted that we had lost Zriller. The sky was always overcast. Crops grew stunted. We have prayed for Zriller's return. How accurate is all this, do you think?
I would have denied it until this morning when you came flying down from heaven.
You make me terribly uneasy, O engineer. Perhaps Zriller does indeed intend to return and sends his bastard ahead to clear the way of false priests.
I could shave my scalp, would that help?
No, never mind. Ask your questions. What can you tell me about the fall of Ringworld civilization? The priest looked still more uneasy.
Is civilization about to fall?
Louis sighed and, for the first time, turned to consider the altar. The altar occupied the center of the pedestal on which they stood. It was of dark wood. Its flat rectangular surface had been carved into a relief map, with hills and rivers and a single lake, and two upward-turning edges. The other pair of edges, the short edges, were the bases of a golden paraboloid arch. The gold of that arch was tarnished, but from the curve of its apex a small golden ball hung by a thread, and that gold was highly polished.
Is civilization in danger?
So much has happened. The Sunwire, your own coming... Is it Sunwire? Is the sun falling on us?
I strongly doubt it. You mean the wire that's been falling all morning?
Yes. In our religious training, we were taught that the sun hangs from the arch by a very strong thread.
This thread is strong.
We know, said the priest. A girl tried to pick it up and undo a tangle, and it cut through her fingers.
Louis nodded.
Nothing's falling, he said. Privately, he thought, not even the shadow squares. Even if you cut all the wires, the squares wouldn't hit the ring world. The engineers would have given them an orbital aphelion inside the ring. He asked without much hope, "What do you know about the transport system at the rim?" And in that instant, he knew something was wrong. He caught something, some evidence of disaster. But what? The priest said, "Would you mind repeating that?" Louis did. The priest answered, "Your thing that talks said something else the first time. Something about a restricted something."
"Funny," said Louis.
And this time he heard it. The translator spoke in a different tone of voice, and it spoke at length.
"You are using a restricted wavelength in violation..."
"I do not remember the rest," said the priest. "We had best end this interview. You have reawakened something ancient, something evil."
The priest stopped to listen, for Louis's translator was speaking again in the priest's language.
"In violation of Edict 12, interfering with maintenance, can your powers hold back?"
Whatever else the priest said was not translated, for the disc suddenly turned red-hot in Louis's hand. He instantly threw it as hard as he could. It was white-hot and brightly glowing when it hit the pavement, without hurting anyone as far as he could see. Then the pain backlashed him, and he was half-blinded by tears. He was able to see the priest nod to him, very formal and regal. He nodded back, his face equally expressionless. He had never dismounted his cycle. Now he touched the control and rose toward heaven. When his face could not be seen, he let it snarl with the pain, and he used a word he had heard once on Wunderland, from a man who had dropped a piece of Steuben crystal 1,000 years old.
Chapter 17. The Eye of the Storm. The cycles were moving to port when they left heaven, beneath the steel-gray lid that in these regions served as a sky. It had saved their lives above the sunflower fields. By now it was merely depressing. Louis touched 3 points on the dash to lock into his present altitude. He had to watch what he was doing, because there was very little feeling in his right hand under the medicines and the spray skin and the single white blister on each fingertip. He regarded his hand now, thinking how much worse it might have been. Speaker appeared above the dash.
Louis, do we not wish to rise above the clouds?
We might miss something. We can't see the ground from up there.
We have our maps.
Would they show us another sunflower field?
You are right, Speaker said instantly. He clicked off.
Speaker and Tila, waiting in Heaven's map room while Louis braced a shaven priest far below, had spent the time well. They had sketched contour maps of their route to the rim wall, and had also sketched in the cities that showed as bright yellow patches in the magnifying screen. Then, something had taken exception to their use of a reserved frequency. Reserved by whom? For what purpose? How long ago? Why had it not objected until now? Louis suspected an abandoned machine like the meteor guard that had shot down the lyre. Perhaps this one worked only intermittently, in spasms. And Speaker's translator disc had turned red-hot and stuck to his palm. It would be days before he could use his hand again, even with the miracle Kazinti military medicines. The muscles would have to regenerate. The maps would make a difference. Resurging civilization would almost certainly show first in the great metropoli. The fleet could cross those sites, watching for lights or rising smoke. Nessus's call button burned on the dash, as it might have burned for a score of hours. Louis answered it. He saw the puppeteer's straggly brown mane and glove-soft back rising and slowly falling with his breath. For a moment he wondered if the puppeteer were back in catatonic withdrawal. Then the puppeteer lifted a triangular head and sang, "Welcome, Louis. What news?"
"We found a floating building," said Louis, "with a map room."
He told the puppeteer of the castle called Heaven, the map room, the screen, the maps and globes, the priest and his tales and his model of the universe. He had been answering questions for some time when he thought of one of his own.
"Hey, is your translator disc working?"
"No, Louis. A short time ago the instrument turned white hot before me, frightening me badly. Had I dared, I would have gone catatonic, but I knew too little."
"Well, the others are gone, too. Tila's burned its case and left a scar on her cycle. Speaker and I both got our hands burned. You know something? We're going to have to learn the ring world language."
"Yes."
"I wish the old man had remembered something about the fall of the old ring society. I had an idea."
And he told the puppeteer his theory of a mutating colonic bacterium.
"That is possible," said Nessus. "Once they lost the secret of transmutation, they would never recover."
"Oh, why not?"
"Look about you, Louis. What do you see?"
Louis did. He saw a lightning storm developing ahead. He saw hills, valleys, a distant city, twin mountain peaks tipped with the dirty translucency of raw ring flooring.
"Land anywhere on the ring world and dig. What do you find?"
"Dirt," said Louis. "So?"
"And then?"
"More dirt, bedrock, ring floor material," said Louis.
And as he said these words, the landscape seemed to alter. Storm clouds, mountains, the city to spinward and the city dwindling behind, the edge of brilliance far away on the infinity horizon that might be a sea or a sunflower invasion. Now the landscape showed as the shell it was. The difference between an honest planet and this was the difference between a human face and an empty rubber mask.
"Dig on any world," the puppeteer was saying, "and eventually you will find some kind of metal ore. Here you will find 40 feet of soil and then the ring foundation. That material cannot be worked. If it could be pierced, the miner would strike vacuum, a harsh reward for his labor. Give the ring a civilization capable of building the ring, and it must necessarily have cheap transmutation. Let them lose the technology of transmutation, no matter how, And what would be left? Surely they would not stockpile raw metals. There are no ores. The metal of the ring would be all in machines and in tools and in rust. Even interplanetary capability would not help them, for there is nothing to be mined anywhere around this star. Civilization would fall and never rise.
Softly, Louis asked, "When did you figure this out?"
"Some time ago. It did not seem important to our survival."
"So you just didn't mention it."
"Right," said Louis.
The hours he'd spent worrying that problem. And it all seemed so vividly obvious now. What a trap. What a terrible trap for thinking beings.
Louis looked ahead of him and was marginally aware that Nessus's image was gone. The storm was nearer now, and it was wide. Doubtless the sonic folds could handle it, but still. Better to fly over it. Louis pulled on a handle, and the fly cycles rose toward the world's gray lid, toward the clouds that had covered them since they reached the tower called Heaven. Louis's mind ran in idle. Learning a new language would take time. Learning a new language every time they sat down would be impossible. The question was becoming crucial. How long had the ring natives been barbarian? How long since they had all spoken the same language? How far had the local languages diverged from the original? The universe blurred, then went entirely gray. They were in the clouds. Tendrils of mist streamed around the bubble of Louis's sonic fold. Then the cycles broke through into the sunlight. From the ring world's indefinite horizon, a vast blue eye looked at Louis Wu across a flat infinity of cloud. If God's head had been the size of the Earth's moon, that eye would have been about the right size. It took Louis a moment to grasp what he was seeing. For another moment, his brain flatly refused to believe it. Then the whole picture tried to fade like a badly illuminated holo. Through the humming in his ears, he heard and or felt someone screaming. "Am I dead?" he wondered. And, "Is that Nessus screaming?" But he cut that circuit. It was Teela. Teela, who had never been afraid of anything in her life. Teela covered her face with her hands, hiding from that vast blue stare. The eye lay dead ahead, dead to port. It seemed to be drawing them toward itself. "Am I dead? Is the Creator come to judge me? Which Creator?" It was finally time for Louis Wu to decide which Creator he believed in, if any. The eye was blue and white, with a white eyebrow and a dark pupil. White of cloud, blue of distance, as if it were part of the sky itself.
"Louis!" Teela screamed. "Do something!"
"It isn't happening," Louis told himself. His throat was a column of solid ice. His mind ran about in his skull like something trapped. "It's a big universe, but some things really are impossible."
"Louis!"
Louis found his voice.
"Speaker. Hey, Speaker, what do you see?"
The Kazin took his time answering. His voice was curiously flat.
"I see a great human eye ahead of us."
"Human?"
"Yes, do you see it too?"
The word Louis would never have used made all the difference. Human. A human eye. If the eye were a supernatural manifestation, then a Kazin should see a Kazinti eye, or nothing at all.
"Then it's natural," Louis told himself. "It has to be."
Teela looked at him hopefully. "But how is it drawing them toward itself?"
"Oh," said Louis Wu.
He moved the steering handle hard right. The cycles curved away to spinward.
"This is not our route," Speaker said instantly. "Louis, bring us back, or put the fleet under my command."
"You aren't thinking of going through that thing, are you?"
"It's too large to go around."
"Speaker, it's no bigger than Plato Crater. We can circle it in an hour. Why take chances?"
"If you are afraid, drop out of formation, Louis. Circle the eye and meet me on the other side. Teela, you may do the same. I will go through."
"Why?"
Louis's voice sounded ragged even to him.
"Do you think that accidental cloud formation is a challenge to your manhood?"
"My what? Louis, my ability to procreate is not at issue. My courage is."
"Why?"
The cycles fell across the sky at cruising velocity, 1,200 miles per hour.
"Why is your courage at issue? You owe me an answer. You're risking our lives."
"No, you may go around the eye."
"And how do we find you afterward?"
The Kazin considered.
"I concede the point. Have you heard of the Kadapt Preacher heresy?"
"No."
In the dark days that followed the Fourth Truce with man, Mad Kadapt Preacher headed a new religion. He was executed by the Patriarch himself in single combat, since he bore a partial name, but his heretical religion survives in secret to this day. Kadapt Preacher believed that God the Creator made man in his own image.
"Man? But Kadapt Preacher was a Kazin."
"Yes. You kept winning, Louis. For 3 centuries and 4 wars you had been winning. Kadapt's disciples wore masks of human skin when they prayed. They hoped to confuse the Creator long enough to win a war."
"And when you saw that eye peering over the horizon at us..."
"Yes."
"Oh, boy."
"I put it to you, Louis, that my own theory is more likely than yours. An accidental cloud formation, really, Louis."
Louis's brain was working again.
"Strike accidental. Maybe the ring engineers set up the eye formation for their own amusement, or as a pointer to something."
"To what?"
"Who knows? Something big. An amusement park, a major church, the headquarters of the Optometrists Union. With the techniques they had and the room, it might be anything."
"A prison for peeping Toms," said Teela, suddenly getting into the spirit of the thing. "A universe for private detectives. A test pattern on a giant tri-D set. I was as scared as you were, Speaker."
Teela sounded normal again.
"I thought it was... I don't know what I thought, but I'm with you. We'll go through together."
"Very well, Teela."
"If he blinks, we'll both be killed."
"The majority is always sane," Louis quoted. "I'm going to call Nessus."
"Finnegal, yes, he must have gone through it already or around it."
Louis laughed harder than he ordinarily would have. He'd been very frightened.
"You don't think Nessus is breaking trail for us, do you?"
"Huh?
He's a puppeteer. He circled around behind us, then he probably slaved his cycle to Speaker's. That way Speaker can't catch him, and any danger he's likely to meet, we'll meet first."
Speaker said,
"You have a remarkable ability to think like a coward, Louis."
"Don't knock it. We're on an alien world. We need alien insights."
"Very well. Call him, since you and he seem to think so much alike. I intend to face the eye and learn what lies behind it or within it."
Louis called Nessus. In the intercom image, only the puppeteer's back was visible. His mane stirred slowly with his breathing.
"Nessus," Louis called.
Then louder.
"Nessus!"
The puppeteer twitched. A triangular head rose in inquiry.
"I was afraid I'd have to use the siren."
"Is there an emergency?"
Both heads came up, quiveringly alert. Louis was finding it impossible to return the vast blue stare ahead of him. His eyes kept sliding away. He said,
"A kind of emergency. My crazy teammates are about to wreck themselves. I don't think we can afford to lose them."
"Explain, please."
"Look ahead of you and tell me if you can see a cloud formation in the shape of a human eye."
"I see it," said the puppeteer.
"Any idea what's causing it?"
"Obviously, it is a storm of some kind. You will already have reason that there will be no spiral hurricane formations on the Ringworld."
"Oh?"
Louis hadn't even wondered about that.
"The spiral form of a hurricane derives from Coriolis force, from the differences in the velocities of 2 air masses at different latitudes. A planet is a rotating spheroid. If 2 masses of air move toward each other to fill a partial vacuum, one moving north and the other south, their residual velocities will carry them past each other. Thus, a whirlpool of air is formed."
"I know what causes hurricanes."
"Then you must realize that on the Ringworld, all contiguous masses of air have virtually the same velocity. There will be no whirlpool effect."
Louis looked ahead of him toward the eye-shaped storm.
"But what kind of a storm would you get? None at all, I'd think. You wouldn't get any circulation of air at all."
"Untrue, Louis. Hot air would rise, cold air would sink, but these effects could not produce such a storm as that ahead of us.
Too right.
What is Speaker threatening to do?
Fly through the center of that finnegal-sired thing with Teela loyally following after him.
The puppeteer whistled a tone as pure and beautiful as ruby laser light.
That seems dangerous. The sonic folds would protect them against the ravages of any ordinary storm, but this looks to be no ordinary storm.
I was thinking that it might be artificial.
Yes, the ringworlders would have set up their own ring-girdling circulation system. But that system would have stopped working when the ring power supply failed. I don't see...
Ah, I have it, Louis.
What is it?
We must postulate an air sink, a region where air disappears near the middle of the storm. All the rest follows. Consider, the air sink creates a partial vacuum. Air masses flow in from spinward and anti-spinward.
And port and starboard.
These we can ignore, the puppeteer said crisply.
But air moving in from spinward will become fractionally lighter than the surrounding air. It will rise. Air moving in from the opposite direction, from anti-spinward, will become fractionally heavier.
Louis was groping with an improperly visualized picture.
Why?
From anti-spinward it comes, Louis. Its rotational velocity is increased fractionally with respect to the ring. Centrifugal force causes it to sink slightly. It forms the lower eyelid of the eye. The air from the spinward, rising, forms the upper eyelid. There is a whirlpool effect, surely, but the axis of the whirlpool is horizontal, where on a planet it would be vertical.
But it's such a minor effect.
But it is the only effect, Louis. There is nothing to interfere with its action or to stop it. It might go on for millennia, building to what you see now.
Maybe, maybe. The eye seemed less frightening now. As the puppeteer had said, it must be some kind of storm. It was all the colors of a storm, of black clouds and upper sunlight white clouds, and the dark eye of the storm acting as the iris of the eye.
The problem is the air sink, of course. Why does air disappear near the center of the storm?
Maybe a pump is still working in there.
I doubt that, Louis. If that were so, the air disturbances in this vicinity would be planned.
Well?
Have you noticed the places where the ring foundation material pokes through the soil and the bedrock? Surely such erosion must be unplanned. Have you noticed how such places appeared more frequently as we neared this place? The ice storm must have upset weather patterns for tens of thousands of miles around, over an area greater than your world or mine.
This time it was Louis who whistled.
Tange for torment.
But then, oh, now I see, there must be a meteor puncture in the center of the eye storm.
Yes. You see the importance of this. The ring floor can be penetrated.
But not by anything we're armed with.
True. Still, we must know if the puncture is there.
Already Louis's superstitious panic seemed a remembered dream. The puppeteer's analytical calm was contagious and steadying.
Louis Wu looked fearlessly into the eye and said, "We'll have to go in and look. You think it'll be safe, flying through the iris?"
"It should be no more than clear still air in a partial vacuum."
"Okay, I'll relay the good news. We'll all fly through the eye storm."
The sky was darkening as they approached the iris. Was night falling overhead? Impossible to tell. The thickening, blackening clouds made darkness enough.
The eye was at least 100 miles long from corner to corner and something like 40 miles tall. Its outline seemed to blur as they approached. Layers and streamers became visible. The true shape of the eye began to show. A tunnel of churning winds, reasonably uniform, whose cross-section was a picture of a human eye. But it still looked like an eye as they hurtled toward the iris.
It was like falling into the eye of God. The visual effect was horrifying, terrifying, almost comically overdone.
Louis was ready to laugh or scream, or back out. It would only take one observer to find out whether there was a hole in the ringworld floor. Louis could go around. Well, they were in. They flew down a black corridor lit by lightning. Lightning flashed almost continuously, ahead and behind and on all sides. For a uniform distance around them, the air was clear. Beyond the iris region,
opaque black clouds swirled around them, moving at greater than hurricane velocities.
"The leaf-eater was right," Speaker roared. "It is nothing but a storm."
"Funny thing, he was the only one of the four of us who didn't panic when he saw that eye. I guess puppeteers aren't superstitious," screamed Louie Wu.
Teela called, "I see something ahead of us."
It was a dip in the floor of the tunnel. Louie grinned with tension and rested his hands lightly on the controls. There might be a tinge of a downdraft over that dip. He was less wary now, less tense than he had been when they entered the eye. What could happen where even a puppeteer found safety? Clouds and lightning whirled around them as they neared the dip. They braked and hovered over the dip, their fly-cycle motors fighting the downdraft. Through the muffled action of the sonic folds, the storm screamed in their ears. It was like looking into a funnel. Obviously, there was air disappearing down there, but it was being pumped away at high speed, or was it being spewed at the stars through the black bottom of the ring world? They couldn't actually see much. Louie did not notice when Teela dropped her cycle. She was too far away, the flickering light was too strange, and he was looking down. He saw a tiny speck dwindling into the funnel, but he thought nothing of it. Then, thinned by the howl of the storm, he heard Teela's scream. Teela's face was clear in the intercom image. She was looking down, and she was terrified.
"What is it?"
he bellowed. He could barely hear her answer.
"It's got me!"
He looked down. The funnel was clear between its whirling conical sides. It was oddly and steadily lit, not by lightning per se, but by cathode ray effects caused by current differences in a nearly complete vacuum. There was a speck of something down there, something that might conceivably have been a fly cycle if anyone were stupid enough to dive a fly cycle into a maelstrom merely to get a closer look at a puncture hole into outer space. Louis felt sick. There was nothing to be done, nothing at all. He wrenched his eyes away, only to see Teela's eyes above the dashboard. She was looking down into something dreadful, and blood was running from her nose. He saw the terror drain out of her face to leave a white corpse-like calm. She was about to faint. Anoxia? The sonic fold would hold air against vacuum, but it had to be set first. Half-conscious, she looked up at Louie Wu. "Do something," she begged. "Do something." Her head fell forward against the dash. Louis's teeth were in his lower lip. He could taste the blood. He looked down into the funnel of streaming neon-lit cloud, and it was sickeningly like the whirlpool over a bathtub drain. He found the tiny speck that must be Teela's cycle, and saw it lunge straight forward and into the sloping, whirling wall of the funnel. Seconds later, he saw the vapor trail appear ahead of him, far down the eye of the horizontal hurricane, a thread of white, sharply pointed. Somehow it never occurred to him to doubt that it was Teela's cycle.
"What happened?" Speaker called.
Louis shook his head, declining to answer. He felt numb. Reason was short-circuited. His thoughts traced a circle, round and round. Teela's intercom image was face down, showing mostly hair. She was unconscious, in an uncontrolled fly cycle moving far faster than twice sonic speed. Somebody really ought to do something about that.
"But she was about to die, Louis. Could Nessus have activated a control we don't know about?"
"No, I'd rather believe that than... no."
"I think that must be what happened," said Speaker.
"You saw what happened. She fainted, her head hit the control board, and her cycle shot out of that drain like hell wouldn't have it. She punched the right controls with her forehead."
"Nonsense."
"Yeah."
Louis wanted to sleep, to stop thinking. "Consider the probabilities, Louis."
The Kazin got it then, and he left his mouth open while he thought about it. His verdict was,
"No, impossible."
"Yeah."
"She would not have been chosen to join us. If her luck were even partially dependable, Nessus would never have found her. She would have stayed on Earth."
Lightning sparkled, illuminating the long, long tunnel of churning storm cloud. A straight, narrow line pointed dead ahead, the vapor trail from Teela's fly cycle. But the cycle itself was beyond visibility.
"Louis, we would never have crashed on the ring world."
I'm still wondering about that.
Perhaps you'd better wonder how to save her life.